Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
What is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home. They never go home. They never go home. Those boys.
That's. Yeah. They have asked for that, really.
Well, you can laugh. It was the World Cup.
I'm a little bit of an idealist, but having said that, I want to be like me.
You don't know what you're talking about.
What did you know?
I managed to stay alive for 6 days.
I'm good to leave it there.
I'd say it to your face, and I'll say it to you now.
I'm down to Anfield, and we'll see them, won't we?
What you doing down here, you shawnee man?
Look, we all read the profiles of Maurizio Sarri when he got the Chelsea job, the incredible story of the former banker who's now managing one of the richest clubs in world football. The only problem is nobody wants a bloody banker in charge of their football team. It doesn't matter if he wins you the Europa League. Get radiant-looking young Frank Lampard in. It's the same at Juve. It does not matter if you win another piddly little Serie A title, Mr. Banker Man. We want Andrea Pirlo's hair in here for the foreseeable future. You're welcome to Monday Second Cabin's Football Podcast. Hi, Ken.
Oh, and how are you?
I'm good. I read with interest your article on Cristiano Ronaldo this morning in the Irish Times. I see you're trying to flog him to Paris Saint-Germain, doing his bidding for him. You're his inside man in the media.
What a great idea. I'm only too happy to get the pom-poms on for this transfer move. This is just a brilliant idea. I mean, I know that this might seem inconsistent for, you know, if people have been listening to this podcast and paying attention, how could I be saying, oh, this is a great idea, Ronaldo should go to PSG. What a dream move for everybody. When Neymar made this same move 3 years ago now, I reacted to it with horror, as though Neymar had effectively excommunicated himself from football. Is there not a bit of inconsistency there? And I would say, no. Ronaldo is really old now. I mean, he is unbelievable. I couldn't believe it. I didn't realize, Owen, until yesterday, just how old he is. I mean, I've always known how old he is. Because I know his birthday is February 5th, 1985. But what I didn't realize was how old he is compared to all the other footballers, which is to say he's the oldest in the Champions League, apart from Huntelaar, who is just a guy who comes on at the end of matches for like a couple of minutes. The oldest forward. There's 690 players in the Champions League this season. 12 of them are older than Cristiano Ronaldo. So, I'm sorry, he's even higher in the percentile of elderliness than he is in the percentile of sort of goal scoring. In fact, he is much higher in elderliness than in goal scoring when you look at this season's goal scoring.
Still,
so what I'm saying is,
yeah,
this guy doesn't really want to be playing too much football anymore. He wants to be playing like about 7 matches a year. The knockout stages of the Champions League, that'll do. And PSG can actually do that. I mean, at Juventus, he's going to be expected to play Serie A, but at PSG, they can say, look, Cristiano, we know what it's all about. And, you know, we can let you come on for, you know, a couple of French league games here. You can have a little bit of a tune-up, you know, bit of shooting practice. And then, you know, when the really important games start, then that's when we'll be counting on you.
Still got it, though. Come on. You know, maybe not the quite the force of old, but he's still the man who scored the goals. He was still trying to drag a team through almost single-handedly. And I have the feeling if he was asked, Cristiano, how are you still the greatest at such an advanced stage of your career? I have an idea how he might answer.
You know, if you look at the younger players coming through, they're not that good really. Do you know what I mean? And most of them are like, you know, wouldn't even wouldn't even make, they'd probably do well as half decent amateurs, do you know what I'm saying? Well, not even amateurs, I mean, they're so bad that, you know, a lot of them that you see now, you just think, Kai, I've probably got to lose an arm and a leg to sort of fall outside the top 50, do you know what I mean? So that's really sort of why we're kind of hovering still around, because of the, just how poor it is down that end, you know?
That was Ronnie O'Sullivan, just to be clear, not Cristiano himself, Ken.
I think it's one of the greatest sports quotes of all time, actually, from Ronnie O'Sullivan there. Just the naked contempt for all of the new little players. I mean, it is, you know, the big picture there is it does suggest it's a kind of a dying sport. You know?
Well, Ken Doherty disagrees. I did see that. So, you know, Ronnie says what he has to say. Ken Doherty and other snooker people feel that the young pros are, they're up there.
I mean, the truth is in the results, right? Is Ronnie O'Sullivan still winning all the time?
He's not winning all the time, but he's just after getting through to the latter stages of the World Snooker Championship yet again, and he's been.
When was the last time he won the championship? Do we know?
That was relatively recent, a couple of years back. Oh, you're killing me here, my snooker. If you'd asked me that, if I didn't know recent World Championship victories, especially by the most famous player in the sport 20 years ago, you could have carted me off, Ken. But that's just the way snooker's gone. So maybe it is if you're using me as a test case as a former snooker fan, then you're probably driving home a point here quite successfully, I would say.
Yeah, look, I'm kind of the same. I'm late 90s, I would have been on top of this. But no, hang on, list of snooker world champions. I'm looking at the winners. The last time he won it was 2013.
Oh, was it that long ago?
Yeah, so okay. I mean, maybe he's having a little bit of a 2013, 2012, 2008, 2004, 2001. 2001 is the first time he won it. Mm. So 2001 is a long time ago in sporting terms. But yeah, 2014 is the last time he's been in the final. So, you know, I don't know if he's really justified in talking about the other players being bad. They're evidently good enough still to beat him. Ronaldo, as far as I know, hasn't said any of those types of things, because if he did, then it would only diminish his own achievements. And I don't think that's part of his natural game.
We're going to hear from, you spoke indeed to James Horncastle earlier today, so we'll hear that after your report on sport, please.
So what's happening is this big finals tournament in Lisbon this week. It's a lot of weeks of drama. It usually is like 6 or 7 weeks to play out the quarterfinals, semifinals, final of the Champions League, but they're cramming it all into 12 days, I think. There's a lot of making up for lost time has to happen, which is apt on, because so many of the leading principals in the Champions League these days are running out of time. Obviously, we know Cristiano has run out of time in 2020 to win the Champions League. The oldest man in the Champions League. Sorry, God, I just can't get over that. I mean, you sound as if, well, of course. I mean, who would be older than him? I just can't get over that he's reached that point.
I've gotten used to him getting older, though. Maybe it was the move to Juventus as well. If he was still at Real, would I even think about his age? Maybe not. But then he goes across there. You're thinking, oh,
the old lady of Turin.
The old man of football playing.
The old man of the old lady.
Yeah.
So we're going to talk to James Horncastle. He's been covering this stuff, but it's interesting what happened with Juventus. Obviously, a hugely disappointing result against Lyon. Tell you, he doesn't have any problem beating Lyon on PSG. Mm-hmm. And that's even without Ronaldo. Sarri, it just didn't work out. And it's funny how some of the same stuff is being said about Sarri by the Juventus players as by apparently Chelsea players, including the fact that his smoking pissed them off. I see that in an article on The Athletic today about Frank Lampard, that some players didn't like Sarri smoking. But apparently Douglas Costa was particularly put out by the smoking of Sarri near the Juventus locker room. Apparently he didn't like this. Other players didn't like things such as Sarri's habit of giving them instructions in training. Ronaldo apparently really didn't like that. And Bonucci and Chiellini didn't like things like being asked to play, being asked to defend a high line. Buffon was... Sarri thought was going to be a big helper, a big leader for him, but apparently was silent as a church mouse whenever he wasn't actually in the team. So he didn't get any help from him either. They have decided to replace him and brought in Andrea Pirlo, which is pretty exciting. So Pirlo is a manager, you know, with no experience, but obviously he's Andrea Pirlo. So who cares about experience? Isn't that, that's kind of the way that things are going now, I guess. I mean, somebody tweeted me a couple of days ago saying that they saw Owen Hargreaves on, I guess it must have been BT Sports, saying, basically giving Frank Lampard the credit for Andrea Pirlo being hired by Juventus. You know, Lampard had, such was Lampard's soaring success, and we'll get back to that.
He did. You just remember, Hargreaves did say that, yeah. And also, Michael Owen was on as well. I was watching this, and Owen just casually dismissed Sarri's last two seasons as though he's just been a complete failure. You know, like, he did well at the little clubs on the way up, your Napoli's of this world, but couldn't hack it at Chelsea or Juve. He hasn't been a total busted flush at these clubs.
He's just old, isn't he? He's just an old guy, you know, boring. just an old, boring man. You know, with his tactics and his game plan. How can that possibly compare to Andrea Pirlo and his impossible glamour? I mean, it's quite interesting because Pirlo just, have you ever seen him speaking? He kind of talks a bit like he's just rolled out of bed. You know what I mean? Which, okay, maybe it's you don't necessarily, not everybody has to be a sort of Jurgen Klopp, you know, hyper energetic type of guy, but he is just he's always been like an extremely chilled out sort of figure, to, you know, one of those people who's quiet in the group, not necessarily, I wouldn't have thought, a manager, but you know, maybe Juventus are looking at it thinking, well, the days of like the dictator coach are maybe over. What we want now is a style icon coach, who sort of looks good and who everybody recognizes. And if that's what they're looking for, then Pirlo already fulfills those criteria. I assume that they're looking for a bit more. Like, I assume that they think he can actually be a good coach. Like, he can actually bring something in terms of how Juventus play the game. You know, he can add something in that respect besides just being sort of a good guy to represent the club. We can get into that, I guess, with...
I think whatever about Hargreaves and Lampard, every big club looks at the Guardiola thing, and that must be in the back of their minds. They must think, well, just because they haven't managed before doesn't mean they won't turn out to be the greatest manager in the game.
Yeah, it's true. But, you know, Guardiola had managed before, though. Guardiola had managed the Barcelona youth side. You know, he coached players, remember he immediately brought in like Busquets and Pedro because he'd been coaching those guys for like a year. Now, Pirlo had been appointed as Juventus under 23 manager, which I guess would have been a similar type of job, except he was only appointed on the 30th of July and it's now the 10th of August and they haven't played any games. So it's like he literally has managed no games. So we don't really know. I mean, obviously Juventus, I'm sure, have spoken to Pirlo. Maybe they've got a sense, as with Guardiola, that here's a guy with a whole like ideology about the game. I mean, that was obvious with Guardiola from an early point. You know, he'd been sort of traveling around the world. He'd been studying with people, you know, Juan Malillo. He'd been studying with Marcelo Bielsa. You know, he's kind of you'd only have to speak to him for a couple of minutes to see, oh, this guy's seriously into this stuff. Now, I don't know if Pirlo necessarily is. That will become clear with time. It'll be interesting to see what kind of manager he turns out to be, because you know he has worked with mainly these, you know, I guess Italian managers. You know, most of his career has been with Juventus and AC Milan, managers like Conte, Carlo Ancelotti. You know, these are the sort of influences on his career. It's not like he's been, you know, necessarily going around the world soaking up different influences. You know, he's gone from playing a long career in Italian football to training as a coach at Coverciano. So maybe he's going to be more of an Italian style coach than, for instance, Sarri. Sarri's obviously Italian, but he's not what you would call an Italian style manager. He's got a different idea of how to play. You know, the likes of Bonucci and Chiellini going, coach, well, you know, why are we so far away from our own goal? This is insane. What are you trying to do? Or like when he'd say something like, I want Pjanic to have 150 touches a game. And everyone's like, what? Like, why? Like, what does that have to do with the game? We'll see if Pirlo maybe takes things back to basics a little bit.
What else is going on? What else caught your eye in the weekend's Champions League action?
Well, you know, it's this, the thing that's happening in the Champions League now is this fading away of this 1980s generation. Obviously, Ronaldo, David Silva, you know, running out of time. Still in it, of course, thanks to Manchester City knocking out Real Madrid. Rafael Varane ran out of time. He seemed to think he had more time on the ball than he had available to him.
Unbelievable.
How can you give away goals like that in a game at that level? It's, you know, it was, you immediately were reminded of Karius. You know, it was almost on that level. Varane, obviously, is a player who has achieved a lot more in the game than Loris Karius.
Well, that's it, yeah. But also that makes it all the more remarkable that it's such a drop. You go from being a world-class defender to just some randomer off the street who could be out there playing those kind of passes.
Well, I mean, you wouldn't, because a randomer off the street would probably play safety first. Like, the first one is just, it's such a bad goal that they gave away, you know, in the sense that, like, they were sort of playing the ball around at the back for so long, and City were kind of advancing on them, closing them down steadily, and nobody woke up. You know, they're just sleepwalking around. Varane eventually just gets robbed by Jesus. He had a number of chances to get rid, let's say. The second one is, again, really bad defending because, okay, it's a very good finish by Gabriel Jesus, who is alive to the possibilities, but there's really no need to weakly head the ball back into the danger area in front of your goalkeeper in that situation. You know, it's not a total disaster if you give away a throw at this point. Mm-hmm. You know, it was really poor. Again, you know, Varane, he's a guy, he's won the Champions League how many times now? 4 times. He's won the World Cup. You know, he's a serious player. Still though, this is Real Madrid. Like, it's been quite an unforgiving club. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if they're kind of never really look at Rafael Varane the same way again after all that. Mm. Although I suppose the weird setting, you know, the general unreality of these games, you know, I say unreality. I have to say that when you're watching them, like the Barcelona-Napoli game was interesting. Yeah. When you're watching them, they're sort of just as absorbing. You know what I mean? Even without the crowd, you don't necessarily need the crowd for the game to be good. But like, there is still something a bit strange about them.
I see there was a small crowd, including in its number Sergio Ramos there in his. Decked out in his nice waistcoat and everything. I'm sure he was looking on thinking, Varane, mate. I mean, well, I've never made a mistake for Real Madrid. How can you?
Well, the silver lining, obviously, from his point of view, is everybody was talking after the game about Sergio Ramos and how it just underlined his importance, you know, and when Varane doesn't have Sergio Ramos there telling him what to do, then this is what you get, mm-hmm. You know? So it obviously, it only increased his legend. Although he does seem to be spending a lot of time recently sitting in the bench or sitting in the stand wearing a little waistcoat watching Real Madrid getting knocked out of the Champions League. It was the same last season against Ajax, remember?
No cameras this time, at least.
Well, I'd be surprised if there weren't cameras following around. I mean,
specifically for a Ramos documentary, but maybe there is another part to that.
What's the point of being Sergio Ramos if you can't document it? You know what I mean? Everyone's seen The Last Dance at this stage. Are you telling me that we're just going to let Ramos's glory, the last days of Ramos, just be washed away like tears and rain? You know, get that stuff on tape. You know, there's no telling how we might be able to put that to use later on. But what else is going on? Who else is running out of time? Robert Lewandowski a little bit. I mean, Lewandowski is in superb form at the moment, but cruelly for him, cannot win Ballon d'Or as a result of the Ballon d'Or having been cancelled because as they announced at the time, well, you know, there's the lack of a sufficiently level playing field means it would be unfair to award the Ballon d'Or, said France Football. France Football. France. When did they cancel their league? Was it the end of April? The French football magazine decides it can't award the Ballon d'Or. I'm sure it's totally independent of the fact that the French league was cancelled. It would be unworthy of the Ballon d'Or. We did not want to put an indelible asterisk on the prize list as a trophy won in exceptional circumstances due to the health crisis of COVID-19. To which, if I'm Robert Lewandowski, I'm thinking, why not? Like, you know, Messi was still playing. Modric was still playing. Ronaldo was still playing. They're the three guys who've won it, you know, in the last, since 2008. It's always been one of those players. And this could have been, would have been my year. If they beat Barcelona on Friday, that's the game. The only two previous winners of the competition play each other on Friday. If Bayern beat Barcelona on Friday, and I have to say, based on watching the Barcelona game, I expect Bayern to beat Barcelona. Then you think Lewandowski's in very good shape to win this trophy if it was being awarded, it's not.
It's any organization that gives out a trophy of any kind takes that trophy and its significance way too seriously in their own heads. Well, that said, I suppose the people winning the Ballon d'Or do build their careers around that now in certain cases. So that could be. But, you know, just give the award. And if one player is pissed off they didn't get it because they didn't get to play quite as many games as the in the grander scheme of things, does that really matter? You might as well give the thing and get the bit of publicity and all that kind of crack.
Yeah, I would have thought so. But, you know, to be honest, I would give Lewandowski the Ballon d'Or just for overcoming Frank Lampard's Chelsea. I mean, he scored or set up all of the 7 goals, which unbelievably Bayern scored against FLC. There is a big piece today in The Athletic. Simon Johnson, Liam Toomey, and more. Dominic Fifield, I think, also contributing, which gives the inside story of Chelsea's season. And it does contain some good highlights. Lampard's a clever man, it says an insider. He's very wealthy, not just from earnings as a player, but has invested in a lot of business ventures. Put it this way, he doesn't have to work again. He's not in this for the money. It's like, this is great. This is wonderful. Although he does have, there are some problems that Lampard has had to face, some hurdles that he's had to overcome in his life. There are some obstacles that he's had to get around, such as Lampard's considered and intelligent demeanor means he can sometimes be underestimated. But this is not someone who should be considered a soft touch, which is also good to know. That his style of play is more exciting than previous Chelsea managers, because instead of 20 passes to go up the field, it was trying to cover the same ground in 2-3 passes and switching the play. The players are very happy with him. He's very easy to get a smile from. The players like that. And he also, Owen, you know the way Frank Lampard has got staff? He's got not as many staff as Sarri. Apparently Sarri was always would like to roll deep. Sarri would turn up to everything mob-handed with like a double-digit number of assistants and hangers-on and this huge coaching entourage. Whereas Lampard likes to keep it a bit more tight, you know, 4-5, that sort of number of assistants. We'll get this, right? He's got a group of assistants, okay? Mm-hmm. But you know what else he's got? He's got a WhatsApp group to which all of those assistants belong.
Wow.
He set up, the 42-year-old set up a WhatsApp group for his coaching quartet to remain in constant contact. The chat is thought to be very busy, especially after a defeat.
Yeah, okay.
A post-mortem of what went wrong is discussed and planning on how to start fixing things in training. But it has also provided a support network for Lampard and those close to him. They lean on each other to lift themselves after a negative result. I thought, what an innovator. Like, this is just such a force multiplier. You know, if you think about it, you've got like your coaches, your assistants and so on, and they're all like good workers in their own right, you know. But imagine you could sort of join them all together and have them in a WhatsApp group where they were able to like swap ideas and like talk over things, even when they weren't in the same room as each other.
It's like the virtual, ground. It's a virtual boot room.
It is. It's like the boot room, but always on. And, you know, it's, in a sense, these guys always have one foot in the boot room. And, you know, that just seems to me to be the kind of thing that could be putting this operation on the next level. You know, it's a bit like there was a story today in the Guardian. I think it's Paul McInnes spoke to Ted Knudsen of Statsbomb. He was saying, you know, I think McInnes had said to Knudsen, you know, it's quite interesting because if you look at like XG, we touched on this last week, I think, with Jonathan Wilson. You know, Liverpool aren't actually doing that well. Like, you know, they're scoring way more than their XG and they're conceding less than their XGA. City should be winning the league easily if you just look at XG. And Ted Knudsen said, well, you know, the fact is, I think Liverpool, some of the edges that they've managed to discover actually lie outside the XG model. Like, the XG model isn't capturing. So some of the stuff they're doing is just a little bit beyond where XG has caught up to, so it's not being captured in the data. See? So I wonder if Jurgen Klopp might have one of these. Might he have set up one of these WhatsApp groups? might that actually be one of the things that's going on here? Mm. You know, it's not just a case of when they drive away from the training ground, you know, 6-7 in the evening or whatever it is, or, you know, that's work finished for the day. Might there actually be an extra level going on? That could be the case. I certainly hope that Jurgen Klopp isn't watching Netflix, because Frank Lampard isn't. He prefers to be on his work laptop, apparently, rather than sprawling on the couch watching Selling Sunset or whatever. He doesn't have time for Selling Sunset.
There's more and more football content on Netflix now. I see there's a Nicola Anelka documentary out. So
I haven't watched it.
No,
have you watched it?
No, I liked the trailer, I must say. Liked the trailer. It grabbed me. Not sufficiently to actually watch it yet, but I mean, I only saw the trailer last night. Maybe people can tweet me, tell me if it's any good.
I think I will definitely be watching Anelka. I mean, I watched a lot of Selling Sunset, so like I kind of have to watch Anelka, really. So look, that was that's the Athletic. As I said, there's lots more where that came from.
Yeah.
So good stuff. And all I'm saying is, well done, Bayern. You know, I would, I guess, watch a video. If anyone can point me to a collection of video of the, you know, it is an amazing statistic when you think about it, but the 79 goals Chelsea have conceded in 55 matches this season. If there is a video that puts them all together, I wouldn't mind watching them, because each one of those is an Everest in its own way. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like to score 79 goals against a team like Chelsea, all I can say is well done to all of Chelsea's opponents. Cause that's some pretty high level stuff. Anyway, So I mentioned Bayern are playing Barcelona, the only past winners, and yeah, I mean the Barcelona game, really, it's really the Barcelona games, as they have been, I guess, for some time now. But I feel really acutely now are just all about Lionel Messi.
Oh yeah, yeah, totally.
And can he do it? Like, can he win this? Can he win this competition one more time? I mean, he's won it 4 times. You know, the first time he was injured for the final, but he had played in the preceding rounds, notably against Chelsea in the quarterfinal, I think it was, in 2006. Obviously instrumental in all the other victories, but none since 2015. And if you look at what's been happening to him in this competition since then, it's been really, really miserable. I was watching Virgin the other day. They had like a documentary about Messi. Messi, unfinished masterpiece. Have you seen this? You heard about this?
No.
It was like an hour long Champions League documentary on Messi. Obviously, they've got access to the Champions League footage. So, like, looking at his whole Champions League career, with Tommy Martin doing a Hugh McElvaney impression. You know, McElvaney's series that is often running on Sky, where he talks about the greats of the game.
Mm.
Your Shankleys, your Busbys. But Tommy Martin talking about Messi, and you know, it was great to watch, just because you almost forget all of the individual moments of of genius, but then also to see just how many like really depressing failures there have been, and particularly in recent years. And now he's 33. It's like, oh my God, you know, this is, there are not going to be many more chances. And Barcelona at the moment do not look really capable of winning. I mean, he's there with Suarez, who at least, you know, was a player pretty much on, not on Messi's level really, but like a player who he had respect for. Suarez is now also getting on. He's also 33. But they're in the team with Griezmann. You know, Griezmann, they finally found a way to put him in, which is basically Griezmann is now going to be the... They're playing basically 4-3-1-2. And it's like Griezmann is like the behind the strikers player. But what behind the strikers means when you're playing with Messi, you know, there is no behind the striker if Messi is one of the strikers. Because what he was doing in this game, what he basically likes to do is go and hang out on the right wing, walk around for a bit, and then get the ball and then attack with like a bunch of... He plays 1-2s and sort of dribbles through, you know, and this is... Like, this is how they attack now. Griezmann is still struggling how to fit into this. I mean, I was reading, there was some interesting stuff, an interesting interview with Dominic Torrent, who is the former assistant of Guardiola. Now he's at Flamengo. But he did an interview there last week with Diego Torres in El País. And he had some interesting stuff to say. One of the things was... He made reference to Xavi's comment about the kind of players who should join Barcelona. Now, Xavi made this comment back in May, which I think was partly wrong, but mostly right. He said, players like Mane and Aubameyang, who, by the way, I think are actually quite different players, but players like Mane and Aubameyang, I suppose one thing they share in common is that they're fast. Players like Mane and Aubameyang, said Xavi, kill you in the open spaces. What Barcelona need is players who like it in the tight spaces, right? Because the way that Barcelona, if you play for Barcelona, then most of your matches are going to be against teams who are defending with pretty much all their players back, sitting back and challenging you to try to find a way through. So you need players who are adept at like unpicking those situations. You don't really... Players who look really good for a team that plays in a lot of space, mm-hmm, sometimes just look lost when it's like, well, we're all just standing around here and like those guys are just set up in a kind of in a phalanx, and like the box is surrounded by a cage of defenders. Like, there's, what am I actually even supposed to do here? You know, this is the point that Xavi is making. And I just thought, remember, what was the thing that Diego Simeone said about Griezmann when Griezmann left Atletico Madrid?
That he's essentially losing two players or something along those lines. How can anyone else do Griezmann does it all over the pitch?
Yeah, it was how can you replace Griezmann? And he said, ooh, it's going to be difficult. What I need is a guy who plays really well in three quarters of the pitch. He scores 20 goals a season and is cheap. There's not many of them around. But three quarters of the pitch, this is the point. When you're at Atletico, then a forward like Griezmann, who's a good runner, is really valuable. You know, he's both willing to come back, and like, because he's part Uruguayan, he's willing to come back, put his knife in between his teeth and fight in the trenches with the defenders to the last drop of blood. I mean, of course, he's Uruguayan. But then when you get the ball, he's ready to spring and sprint 70 yards forward to finish off the lightning counterattack that your attacking play is based around. So this is what Griezmann made his name doing, both for Atletico Madrid and for one of his two homelands, France. This is the kind of football, both of France, maybe less than Atletico. But again, you know, France are that kind of team. Let's defend and let's attack the space. And here he has gone to the one team where this skill is irrelevant. You know, it's like, that's exactly the kind of player we don't buy here. Although, of course, they are buying them. So this is one of the reasons why Barcelona as a team doesn't really work.
Yeah.
You know, you've got like, it's sort of like, it's just Messi is like unbelievably brilliant. I mean, his goal was just ridiculous. you know, how many, did he beat like four players in sort of a couple of little moves?
Well, it's like when he lost the ball a couple of times along the way, but he kept, you know, everyone else, it was ricocheting around in such a way that nobody knew what was going on except Messi. So he seemed to be following the ricochets. And even then, as he falls, like almost every other player in the world would have kicked the ball as they started to fall. He gave it another second, waited for the defender to come across a little bit more so he had the angle to then kick it while he was almost on his arse. And the second the goal that was disallowed, I thought was as good. You know, it was one of those ones where ball is being pinged over the defender at the far post and you're thinking, as it's coming over, it's like, this is barely a half chance, because if it gets to the attacker, it's one of those ones where the defender's been in his way right the way until the last second. But because it's Messi, you're saying, as soon as it goes over that guy's head, he's going to score a goal here, which he did. Took it down, we thought, on his chest. There was a bit of a hand involved. Then again, the little bit of a, you know, the keeper thinks he's hitting into the far post. There's so many goals that Messi scores that are amazing in real time. And then you watch the replay and they're even better. There's always another little kink or there's some other little wrinkle to the thing that looks even better in a replay.
Yeah, it was incredible. Although, I mean, he is seeing this stuff in slow motion. Like, that is, at some fundamental level, that's what's going on here. I mean, he's seeing it in the same time as the rest of us and playing the same time as the rest of us. He just has a higher level sort of graphics processor. He's just able to take in and absorb and process more information in the same amount of time. When he's there with very little space between the control and the goalkeeper sort of coming towards him, that he's just like, well, this is easy because like the goalkeeper's got like 6 feet of space above him there. All I need to do is just lift it over into that space and this is an easy goal. Whereas anyone else would be like, oh, you know, just swing the boot at it. Maybe this will go past the goalkeeper. It's crazy what he does. But then, you know, and even the penalty was a phenomenal piece of play by him. And this is one of the things that makes him sort of exceptional. And he's still able to do it, even though he's now 33. It's this ability to just reach the ball before you. You know, I've heard teammates of his talk about, like, he's always going to get to the ball first. And Koulibaly obviously didn't really think he was even going to be challenged for this ball. He's just preparing to clear the ball. Messi sneaks behind him, stretches his foot out, and manages to kind of scoot along on one leg till his foot just gets there and touches the ball ahead of Koulibaly, who then clears Messi's foot effectively. And that's when you're thinking, oh no, this is a heart and mouth moment here. They're going to get a penalty for this, but like, is Messi now out for the next 6 months? You know, every injury that he gets now could be like, that could be it. You know, there's this real kind of sense of this is about to end. There could be like a record scratch moment at any second here. So it's really dramatic. They're playing Bayern on Friday. I don't see how they can not lose to Bayern. I honestly just don't. I mean, I do see how they can not lose to Bayern. Messi could do something amazing. But as far as I can see, that's the only way that they can survive against this Bayern, who just have so much more in physical terms than they have. They've just got so much speed compared to Barcelona that I don't, you know, Messi's going to be up against Alaba. He's going to be up against, what's the Bayern? Alphonse Davies, like two of the quickest defenders in the Champions League. Even for him, I think this is going to be a tough ask.
It's time to get busy, this motherfucker.
Like we always do about this time.
Okay, I'm going to reveal a piece of information now as well. I haven't smoked a cigarette in 4 days.
So what I'm saying is to this guy, cheer up. How about you fucking wake up? Wake up. Wake up to what's happening in the world.
Well, it's great to speak to James Horncastle on the pod today. James, how are you doing?
Very good, thanks, Ken.
James, the sense of an ending for Juventus on Friday night becomes immediately a new beginning. These very clever Juventus directors throwing a dead cat on the table in the form of the very stylish Andrea Pirlo. This was, first of all, before we get into Pirlo, his appointment is obviously really interesting. Where did it all go wrong for Sarri? I mean, you got the sense at Chelsea that, you know, I mean, I was reading, for instance, in The Athletic today, in the extensive Frank Lampard insider piece, that the players were bored by his repetitive Italian style training drills. But apparently these repetitive Italian style training drills are no longer popular in Italy either.
Yeah, from what I'm told, this was an issue, at least with some players, because I think there was buy-in from the veterans at Juventus, the veteran Italians, like Leonardo Bonucci, for example. But you can imagine when, you know, Cristiano Ronaldo is being told, one-touch Cristiano, two-touch Cristiano, when he likes to run with the ball at his feet, he likes to do several step-overs, he likes to try and beat his man, basically just allow defences to organise themselves and make it difficult to be broken down. That those kind of commands are not always appreciated. But I don't think it was the training methods alone that did for Sarri. I think there are a number of kind of things regarding his compatibility for the job, which were already apparent, you know, when they appointed him in the first place, because he just seems to stand for everything that Juventus do not represent. You know, they have this motto, which is winning isn't important, it's the only thing that matters. But clearly when you appoint a coach like Sarri, how you win does matter, or at least it matters to him. And I think the hierarchy at the club over the last 9 months, he said things that they didn't always want to hear, which was I don't know if you've read any of Charles Bukowski's novels, Ken, but Sarri's no. He's a big fan of Bukowski's style, which is to be very kind of raw, crude, and direct. And Sarri certainly didn't hold back in what he thought about the team and the club's ambitions. For example, he said that, you know, the Champions League is a dream for Juventus. It can't be a real objective because, you know, we play in a league which it's not what it once was. You know, it's Serie A isn't all it was cracked up to be 20 years ago. It's fallen on hard times. And, you know, probably there are 10 or 11 clubs in Europe that that can win the Champions League. And maybe we're one of them. And that did not chime with what the club wanted to do. And, you know, I think ultimately that way of communicating ended up with them deciding that there was just too much of a disconnect it didn't make it worth persisting because, you know, after the elimination on Friday night, the key word that Andrea Agnelli, the president, kept saying was like, we need to go into next season with enthusiasm. And it was clear that persisting with Sarri wasn't going to get that enthusiasm back.
Yeah, I can understand, though, a certain amount of frustration from Juventus at hearing Sarri say something like, you know, it can only be a dream for us. I mean, they have been in the final twice in recent seasons. You know, they've been close on other occasions. They've always been among the best teams. So why shouldn't it be an objective for them to win the league? Or the Champions League, I should say.
Well, exactly. And as we're seeing around Europe, in the Bundesliga, in Liga, and in Serie A, the league is no longer enough, at least in the media's eyes and at least in the fans' eyes. And this is, you know, the reaction from the club is there's been some pushback to that. It's like, look, winning 9 league titles in a row is a staggering achievement. Let's not forget, you know, where Juventus were at in 2011. Yeah, they finished 7th in back-to-back years. AC Milan and Inter were wealthier in terms of, you know, sort of the revenues that they were making. They were paying their players a lot more money as well. And it was unexpected that Juventus won the league in that first season under Conte. But yeah, since they've basically established their dominance in Serie A and have grown their business to such an extent that it makes it very difficult for other teams to compete with them, it's natural that the principal objective of the season is the Champions League. And when you sign a player like Cristiano Ronaldo 2 years ago, who, as Agnelli said on Friday night, is the best player in the competition's history, yeah, the natural assumption to make is that the ambition is to lift that trophy for the first time since 1996. And the troubling thing is that since they signed the final piece of the puzzle, which Cristiano was meant to be, they've actually gone backwards. You know, they went out in the quarterfinals last year and actually needed a kind of miracle from Cristiano just to get to the quarterfinals, because he scored that hat-trick in the second leg against Atletico to turn that tie around. And they've gone out in the round of 16 this year to a Lyon side, which has finished, what, seventh in Ligue 1. And, you know, while it hasn't, you know, I think they went into that game with only one competitive match under their belts in 5 months and were supposed to be rusty. And, you know, that is not acceptable to the Juventus hierarchy at the moment. They wanted very much to be in this final eight tournament in Lisbon, not least perhaps because it foreshadows maybe what a European Super League might look like. But, you know, they're keenly aware of the need for a club like Juventus to be at events like that, to have Ronaldo at events like that, to be the centre of attention, and they're not. And, you know, as I said, for Sarri, yeah, that led to this definitive decision on Saturday morning that he was sacked, a decision that Juventus initially said that they were going to take a few days to consider. Well, it's clearly that they'd already made their minds up about Sarri.
A few days were like Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday last week.
Exactly.
Pirlo comes in and he's, you know, he's the complete opposite end of the scale from Sarri. He's almost his opposite in every way, actually. But one thing that we can say about him is he's young and he's inexperienced. He has had zero matches as a coach. You know, but it's quite interesting, isn't it? This thing that's happened, you know, that like Sarri's 20 jobs almost seem like a car with 20 previous owners. Like the way that people look at it now, like the best trainers now, you look at Lampard's, you know, the best, you know, the desirable trainers for a big club are bucks fresh.
Yeah. And Juventus over the last 18 months have kind of really tried to rebrand themselves as kind of young and fresh. You know, I attended, it was virtual, but there was one of those Madrid World Football Summits only a couple of weeks ago, in which one of Juventus' directors was talking, and they said, look, we don't want to be seen as a football club, or exclusively as a football club. We want to be kind of a brand. We want to be a lifestyle. That was the word. The lifestyle was really important. And, you know, no footballer has kind of emoted a lifestyle better, I would say, than Pirlo in recent years. He sat back in his vineyard drinking wine or sort of just looking like the most stylish guy that the game has ever produced. But, you know, that has to be a secondary consideration for Juventus, because ultimately a brand can only be successful if the team is successful. And I think this goes in the trend of facilitators. You know, Pirlo knows what it takes to be a successful at Juventus, to be in that dressing room. He knows what big-time players need to hear in big moments. That was something that one of his mentors, Carlo Ancelotti, excelled at in the AC Milan team that he was a part of. And, you know, I think one of the reasons why, I wouldn't say Sarri failed, but disappointed, was ultimately a kind of scheme-oriented or tactic-based manager. It's difficult to tell Cristiano what to do when you perhaps don't have the kind of background that Pirlo has had.
You think Pirlo can do that any better than Sarri?
I think Pirlo will have better backing in the dressing room than Sarri did, which isn't to say Sarri didn't have any support at all. But I do think, you know, the likes of Buffon, Bonucci, Chiellini will be there to kind of help him get a message across, which Sarri admitted after the first leg against Lyon, that he just wasn't getting through to the players.
Are those guys all older than him, by the way? Well, not Bonucci, but it's Chiellini Chiellini couldn't be older than Pirlo, but Buffon definitely is. Okay, only one of them is actually older than the manager.
Yeah, only one of them. But I think there's this, from everything that Juventus have said, it's this understanding of the club, which is key, which kind of points to this idea that Sarri just didn't understand really what Juventus were about. But I mean, you look at what's happened over the last 3 years. Juventus have established themselves at the top in Serie A because they've had stability and because they, you know, for the most part, have been unflappable. You know, they had Conte there for 3 years. They would have had him there probably for more if he hadn't walked out on them in the first few days of pre-season. Then they had Allegri for 5 years. And since they've signed Cristiano, this is their third manager in 3 years, which I think in some respects is telling because it shows that the pressure that Cristiano brings, in that it's the pressure of his own ambition being brought to bear on the club, but it's also the pressure that, you know, they know that they need to make the most of this window to win the Champions League. And they know that having a player like Cristiano on the team, yes, it is making the club wealthier. It is allowing them to renegotiate their sponsorships and their commercial partnerships. But it's a burden. You know, he costs a hell of a lot of money to have on the team every year. So I think that's why we're seeing this kind of turnover at Juventus that was really uncharacteristic of their success. And it's not an easy situation for a new manager who hasn't even overseen a training session, even at youth level, to come into. So I think that's one of the reasons why it's going to be quite a fascinating storyline to follow over the next 9 months or however long he lasts.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, we can sort of only wish him well. You know, it's difficult to know how somebody is going to adapt to the challenge of being a manager, even if, you know, previously he may not have... There's not much about his demeanor, Andrea Pirlo, I think, that screams, you know, this guy's definitely going to be a coach. Like, he doesn't seem like a kind of an instruction shouting, room dominating sort of guy. But you know, as I suppose we've been saying, maybe what the game needs from top coaches now is changing a little bit. Let's talk then about the actual team on the field. What's going wrong for them? I mean, Lyon aren't supposed to be remotely near Juventus's level. I mean, we can see that Ronaldo has obviously delivered goals, you know, and he's delivered goals specifically in the knockout stages of the Champions League. The problem is nobody else is scoring in the knockout stages of the Champions League. Nobody has scored since he's arrived in those matches. And if you look at the team in general, if you look at their goals in all competitions, it's quite interesting. 2018, the season before Ronaldo arrived, 112 goals total. Dybala scored 26, Higuain 23, Mandzukic 10. The midfield scored 30 goals. I'm counting guys like Bernardeschi and Cuadrado as midfielders here. Okay, so 112 in all competitions, 87 the first season that Ronaldo arrived. So we've got a big drop-off immediately of 25. Ronaldo scores 28. Dybala and Mandzukic are both down to 10. The midfield is down to 19 from 30. So, and the season just finished. They've scored 99, which is a bit of an improvement. Ronaldo scored 37. A lot of penalties in there, it has to be said. Dybala, 17. A bit of an improvement from him. Higuain, 11. So again, you know, and the midfield is 15. So what it looks like, based on the kind of crude goal figures, is that, yes, Ronaldo has scored goals, but they've concentrated a lot of the goals scoring through Ronaldo at the expense of the rest of the team.
Yeah, it was a little bit like the situation that Sarri had at Chelsea last year, where I think he accepts that he either doesn't have all of the personnel he needs to play his football, and so he has this kind of hybrid, and he just focuses quite cynically on maximising the best player on the team, which was Eden Hazard last year, it was Cristiano Ronaldo this year. But structurally, I think, you know, the club has acknowledged this and hasn't put the blame exclusively on Sarri for how underwhelming this season has been. The midfield just doesn't compare with what it was when they first reached the Champions League final in Berlin under Allegri and lost to Luis Enrique's Barcelona. You know, that midfield had Pirlo playing as the deep line playmaker. It had Vidal, who was always reliable for getting goals from midfield. In fact, I think he was often Conte's top scorer. And then you had Pogba and Claudio Marchisio. And at the moment, the midfield has really been assembled on free transfers, which looks more like financial operations first, football operations second. in that, you know, for a club that has a player like Cristiano Ronaldo on its books and needs to meet certain financial fair play criteria, you can always fall back on the insurance of, you know, everything I get from selling a Emre Can is going to be profit. Everything I get from selling an Adrian Rabiot is going to be profit. Same for Aaron Ramsey. And the reality is that these midfielders don't really knit together. And you know, I think one of the key moments this season was in the tunnel at halftime in Lyon, the first leg 5 or so months ago, where you see Cristiano Ronaldo and Paulo Dybala having this animated discussion saying, God, we're getting no service whatsoever. You know, the guys in midfield, they can't win a second ball. They're not first to the ball. You know, we're just on our own out here. And yeah, Dybala, even though he scored, what, 17 goals, Dybala's had a great season. He was named the MVP in Serie A. But I think it's a combination of that midfield not being up to standard or not being able to play the kind of football that Sarri wanted. And they'll have to intervene in that over the next few weeks. And the defence, which has been the foundation for Juventus over the last 9 years, defence shipped 43 goals this year, which I think the last time a team won the league conceding that much was in the 1950s. So that's got to get better, and that is something that Juventus pride themselves on. It was one of the reasons why this cultural shift from, or cultural revolution, if you want to call it that, from Allegri and Conte to Sarri was so fascinating, because as Chiellini reminded Spurs about, you know, Spurs'
the history of the Tottenham,
Spurs' identity of being flaky. Juventus' identity, as expressed by Chiellini, has been a team that wins games 1-0 and likes the tension of defending a lead. And I think that disconnect, again, between what Juventus' DNA is and what Sarri's ideas are, was, one of the reasons why everything collapsed.
So just on the midfield, I mean, it is interesting that, you know, the stuff that when Ronaldo and Dybala are saying stuff like this, it's obviously crushing for the players involved too. On that occasion where Betancur, who, you know, is I think, I mean, he's still someone they're counting on, I guess, for next season. Pjanic, who they have sold to Barcelona, or who's leaving for Barcelona. Rabiot, who I think has just been a total failure. I mean, maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong there, but he didn't seem to have.
No, I think first 7 months of the season, you're absolutely, that was the perception.
So has he improved? Has he sort of
did better after the restart? But again, I wouldn't say he did enough to really convince fans really that he's the future of that midfield. That, you know, the dream, as expressed repeatedly over the last year until COVID hit, was, you know, and things improved at Manchester United, was this idea that Paul Pogba would come back and play in that position, which financially is just impossible. But you know, Bentancur, I think, is the only player in midfield who's convinced on a regular basis this season, and he's part of this younger generation which is trying to come through at Juventus. Because this was the other thing that Agnelli referenced on Friday night, was I keep hearing people say we've got the oldest team in Europe, and I started to listen to them, and I've started to look at the team, and it's like, yeah, damn, it's old. And so I think what they've done, you see there's Matthias de Ligt there, there's a centre back called Meri Demiral from Turkey who is very promising, but suffered a cruciate ligament injury in January. There's Bentancur, there's Dybala, who's still 26. I think those are the players, as well as Cristiano, that they want to build around, and they want to get younger, because yeah, clearly it is a very old team.
Yeah, I mean, and that's one of the reasons I feel sorry for their midfielders. You know, it seems to me that a guy like Pjanic, who's left, and I just wonder what's your verdict on his career there. He's joined Barcelona, which is an amazing move for him. Like, well, it's incredible how he's failed upwards into the midfield of Barcelona. And I say failed, which is harsh, because I think he's a good player. But like, you know, if Ronaldo and Dybala are contemptuously discussing how they feel alone out there because all they've got in midfield is you, then it hasn't, you know, it could have gone better, you could say. Pure, you know, obviously they've replaced this guy. But I feel a bit sorry for him. I don't see how, there's not a lot of players who can succeed in midfield behind players like Ronaldo, Dybala, Higuain, if, you know, unless they're also like super athletic, which obviously Pjanic isn't really. He's just kind of a normal player. He's not the kind of bionic midfielder who might be able to survive in a midfield where your forward line is that uninterested in trying to get the ball back for your team. I mean, how can anyone succeed there unless they, you know, this, I can't, you know, you're thinking of, I mean, it's hard even to think of a player who would be able to thrive in that sort of situation.
Well, I mean, this was supposed to be Pjanic's season as well, because when Maurizio Sarri was unveiled, you know, everything was about who's going to be your Jorginho in the team. And he said, you know, look, I want Miralem Pjanic to have 150 touches a game, which he never got near. And I don't think that's necessarily on Pjanic. I think it's, again, a consequence of having a player like Cristiano in the team. Because with Cristiano, you can't expect him to track back. You can't expect him to press. And so you need someone like Blaise Matuidi often behind him. Because Matuidi can be three players in one. He can do the kind of physical running that you can't expect of Cristiano. And that kind of warps the characteristics of the midfield away from what Sarri wanted. And I've never seen a player come across as being so disappointed to go to Barcelona as Pjanic has been since it was communicated to him. And again, you know, the sense that this is a kind of financial operation first and a football operation second, because it allows both clubs to make a profit prior to June 30th, when, you know, they were due to get their accounts into UEFA for financial fair play analysis. Look, you know, Juventus do get younger in midfield with Arta coming in. He is someone who's got the technical ability that they are looking at for their midfield. But, you know, kind of Pjanic is supposed to be that player. And it again goes to show how all these things kind of around, you know, having Cristiano in the team, but also having Cristiano on the balance sheet kind of affect the dynamics within the team. Because, you know, as we've seen repeatedly in January last year, last summer, where Juventus all of a sudden seemed to be kind of offering players like Dybala, for example, to Spurs, Man United last year, Mario Mandzukic to Manchester United last year, Emre Can to PSG, and then they sold him to Borussia Dortmund, you know, trying to get offers for Bernardeschi, De Ciglio. All these players, you kind of know that they're expendable, essentially. You know, you have to ask yourself what effect does that have on the kind of sense of belonging at a club? Which I use that phrase because that's what Italians use all the time. It's really important that players feel that they belong. And ultimately, when you know you know that you're at a family club, but one that's also unsentimental and thinks about the bottom line first rather than, you know, sort of let's grow old together. You know, I think that is. That is a bit of an issue, really, and might have played a role in Juventus giving this impression that they were losing that winning feeling towards the end of the season, which again was one of the reasons why the club intervened.
Yeah, okay, and just on the issue of Ronaldo himself, he is the oldest forward in the Champions League, with the exception of Huntelaar, who only played Huntelaar played like 37 minutes as a substitute for Ajax. And aside from him, Ronaldo's the oldest attacking player in this season of the Champions League. So I assume next season he'll be the oldest forward full stop in this competition. And yet he's, you know, he's here at 31 million a season in salary or whatever, which is way more than everybody else in Juventus. He doesn't want to run around for obvious reasons. He's incredibly old. He doesn't really dribble anymore. I mean, you know, per game.
Fabio Capello said at the start of the season, I haven't seen Cristiano beat a man in 3 years.
Yeah. You know, he obviously scored that great goal against Leon, that shows, I mean, it's not like he never runs with the ball, but he didn't run with the ball past somebody. You know, he kind of, he maneuvers himself into a position where he can shoot the ball past players. You know, I'm not saying Cristiano Ronaldo is not still an outstanding player. Clearly he is, but they've just got a lot of eggs in this basket. And if PSG are interested in signing him, which, you know, some sort of initial reports are suggesting at least George Mendes may be interested in moving him there, you know, that seems to me like a really good idea for everyone concerned. What I wonder about this is specifically from Juventus's point of view, how do you think that notion would be greeted at Juventus? You mentioned the fact that he sort of boosted their, you know, commercial appeal, which I'm sure is true. He's also boosted their expenses because he costs a lot. He's maybe not had a good effect on the team, judging by how it's done since he's arrived. How are they thinking about this this prospect?
So they're convinced he'll stay. They are all in on Cristiano. They think he raises competition in training. They think he's a good example to their young players, which is a project that you know, perhaps hasn't got the attention it deserves. You know, Pirlo was initially announced as the under 23 coach, which is this Barcelona B Castilla project that Juventus launched a couple of years ago to basically bring through young players. Yeah, they see the effect that Cristiano has had on their appeal. You know, Matthijs de Ligt, I think, wanted to go and play for Juventus. This new generation of players who've essentially grown up watching Cristiano, they want to play with him. They want to join Juventus for that reason. And I mentioned the kind of commercial and sponsorship impact that Cristiano has made. You know, you have Juventus kind of, they're really delighted to basically tell you that they have, they're one of the most followed clubs now on social media, that their following has gone up through the roof, which means that there are more eyeballs on Juventus all the time, that the world is more aware of what Juventus are doing every day because Cristiano is there. I think they think that's worth it. But you know, as Cristiano kind of showed in his Instagram post after the elimination, you know, he expects more. He wants the team to be better, and it's kind of like a catch 22. It's like, well, can they invest in the team to the level that he perhaps needs in order to equip the team to be up to his kind of standards and to be a Champions League contender? Because right now they look further away than they were before they signed.
Okay. Just before they go, James, we haven't talked about Atalanta yet, which we really should have at this stage. They are still in the Champions League, unlike Juventus. What is their secret? I mean, we're just looking at what Atalanta have been doing this season. You know, if Andrea Pirlo is trying to figure out how to get Juventus scoring more goals, then one of the things he probably should be doing and has been doing is looking at Atalanta, who have just scored an unbelievable number of goals. I mean, I think it's 98 in Serie A. I can't see, where's the total for the... Yeah, the 98 in the league is the highest for a very long time in Serie A, although it has generally been a very high-scoring season. Is there any reason that leaps out at you as to why that is? I mean, I mentioned the penalties, Immobile, who won the Golden Shoe, scored 14 penalties out of 36, which is a huge number. I don't know if there's some penalty related reasons why the goal scoring totals have generally been so high. But you also said Juventus have conceded 43. It seems as though the general goal scoring tallies in Serie A are kind of creeping upwards, or maybe going a bit faster than that.
Yeah, I think it's the second second in Europe for goals per game behind the Bundesliga this season. I think was top after the restart. I think there are a few reasons for that. You touched on the penalties. In Italy, the interpretation of the already ambiguous handball rule is the strictest that there is in Europe. It's like, you know, if the ball touches your hand anywhere, it's essentially a handball and a penalty.
So they've got like the rule that says the rule that cancels out lots of goals in the Premier League is actually creating penalties in Serie A.
Yeah, more or less. And then you have a new generation of coaches coming through who are often players who grew up in the Sacchi era, and saw you know, how football should, quote unquote, be played, in comparison with, you know, what they were being coached in those days, which was, right, guys, we're in front. Yeah, let's play to keep our 1-0 lead and shut things down and maybe nick something on the counter. That's changed. And I think as the world has become much smaller and access to, you know, sort of other leagues, yes, for example, watch Pep's Barcelona and all these teams in the Bundesliga play such cavalier football. I think it has kind of, there's been a cross-pollination there, and you've got a lot of new coaches who in Italy are judged to have a quote-unquote European style. That's how they define it, which means you're not defensive. You're looking to build up from the back. And then also just listening to some of the older players who've won the top scorer prize in Italy in recent years. So like Luca Toni, who did it when he basically came back from, I think, playing in Dubai. And Fabio Quagliarella as well, another guy in his mid-30s. Their explanation for that was not too dissimilar from Ronnie O'Sullivan's interview yesterday, which is, yeah, it's just not what, defenders aren't what they used to be. You know, they're asked to do too many things these days, you know, like sort of build up from the back and split center backs and be playmakers. And, you know, back when we were starting out, you know, we'd get kicked 15 times. They wouldn't do anything other than defend. They would follow us to the bathroom. And now it's just much easier to score. I think the O'Sullivan protocol applies to Serie A in some respects as well.
Okay. Do you think that Atalanta have a chance then of knocking out possibly Ronaldo's next team, PSG, with a shock and awe display of goal scoring on Wednesday in Lisbon? Assuming this all goes ahead and isn't like virused off at the last second, that match is Wednesday. And do you think Atalanta can win?
I do, particularly if Mbappe is not playing. I mean, they're still going to have to put up with Neymar, Mario Cardi, who, you know, is the kind of cold-blooded striker that I think PSG have been crying out for. I think this will be the most entertaining quarterfinal of the lot, because I think Atalanta do believe that they can go through in a one-off game against the PSG side, which, yeah, for whatever reason, mentally has found the pressure difficult to deal with on this stage. PSG should win the Champions League this year. They're on the right side of the draw. They'll play RB Leipzig or Atletico, and it's not an Atletico side. That was what it was a few years ago. They should reach the final. And for that reason, I think Atalanta will go through.
Great stuff. James Horncastle, brilliant to talk to you on the show today.
For fuck's sake.
We need to get back to facts here, because there seems to be a bit of emotion creeping in. What you just said really isn't true.
Well, no. No, what I said.
I'm not saying.
I don't know what you're saying, to be honest with you.
Okay.
I
mean,
all I can
say is, if you found someone on the street,
you already interviewed me.
He's a god, he's a god, he's a man, he's a guru.
You cheeky bastard.
You're one microscopic cog in his catastrophic plan, designed and directed by his red right hand.
He did. I've heard.
Who did?
Let me finish. What happened to Chelsea?
For fuck's sake.
Well, this is going splendidly, everybody.
Put the cameras up if you want. Let's have a chat. Everybody would think that the appointment of Jose Mourinho would have been a great appointment for Manchester United to win trophies. That they would win trophies under Jose Mourinho.
Well, I don't think everybody would have thought that, but I think somebody who didn't know a lot about football would have thought that.
What, the Manchester United? Jose Mourinho?
Yeah.
You cheeky bastard.
For fuck's sake.
You cheeky bastard.
For fuck's sake.
You cheeky bastard.
For fuck's sake.
All right, so what are we looking at? This feast of European football during the week, the Champions League quarterfinals in Lisbon, Atlanta, PSG, Wednesday night, Red Bull Leipzig, or RB Leipzig, I should say. Atletico Madrid, that is Thursday night. Friday is Ken talked about Barcelona Bayern. Then Man City Leon on Saturday. So we'll be talking about all those games on the World Service during the week. And there's also the Europa League to consider, Ken. That'll pop up in conversation tomorrow. United playing Copenhagen.
Yes. Man United against Copenhagen in Cologne. Inter against Leverkusen in Dusseldorf. That's tonight. Tomorrow, Wolves against Sevilla and Shakhtar against Basel. So, yeah. Although Man United, also one of those teams running out of time. We were talking about Jadon Sancho last week, Owen. But Jadon Sancho was on Dortmund's preseason tour, which has started. They've gone to Switzerland. He was on the flight. They had said, and Dortmund tend to be sticklers about this sort of stuff. They'd said, you know, if he's not sold by the time we go on our preseason tour, we're not selling him. So maybe Man United have missed the bus on Jadon Sancho. I mean, you know, just because Dortmund say something doesn't necessarily mean it's always true. However, that is what they've said. So I guess the chances of him actually being a Man United player next season are not as good as perhaps we made it sound like last week.
Okay, well, that's all on the way on the World Service. If you want to become a member and you're not already, you can do it on secondcaptains.com. Tomorrow, we're going to have US Murph on the show. He was one of the privileged few who was in Harding Park, the golf course, over the weekend to see a fairly outstanding final round of the USPGA. And he was reporting on it for the New York Times, no less. So I'm going to ask him a bit about it. I know, I knew that would impress you, Ken. We'll talk more about that tomorrow. That's it for today. Thanks for listening. Thanks, Ken.
Thank you, Owen.
Thanks, folks. We'll see you tomorrow. Bye-bye.
That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
The second captain's World Service.
It is not war and death and famine. It's not that at all. It's the opposite of that. It's the persuasion of the world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.